Greetings to all of God's people. This is again Mordecai Joseph. We're today in lesson 180 in the book of Acts. At this point, in verse 28, Agrippa, the king, after listening to the words of the apostle Paul, that was his reaction. He said, as we read here, "You almost persuade me to become a Christian, a follower of Christ." Because he knew the scriptures, he knew the law, he knew the prophets, and therefore, intellectually at least, academically, he had no reason to refute anything that the Apostle Paul has said. And normally, every single person who has been raised on the law, who knows the law, knows the prophets, has no reason whatsoever to reject whatever the Apostle Paul was teaching, or the apostles themselves, or Jesus Christ when he appeared on the scene. You see? And yet, the reality is, knowledge is not everything. Even believing that this is true is not everything. Believing that Jesus Christ is the Savior and the Redeemer and the one that came and died and rose and paid the penalty for all mankind. You see, all these things become academic knowledge if God does not call you and plants His faith in you and reveals His Son in you and gives you your Holy Spirit, that is His Holy Spirit. You see, if all those things don't happen, academic knowledge doesn't bring you beyond that point. And so this is where Agrippa is. Every honest, every sincere Jew who goes through all these statements, ponders them, remembers all that he's been taught by the law and the prophets, would have to agree it's true. But he cannot go beyond that point. Why? Because the faith is lacking. And that faith is not something that he can produce on his own. There is a human faith, you know, that we can produce on our own. But the human faith does not translate that into a total faith and belief and conviction and desire to do something about it and action and results. You see, it is of God both to do and to will. And those things are lacking unless God gets into the action. And so Agrippa cannot go beyond that point, neither can anybody else, even though a lot of people call themselves Christians. They really can't go beyond that. That's where they cannot bring themselves, even if they study and read all these things and go through all these series. If God does not deal with any one who goes through all these series and the whole law and the prophets, that person, man or woman, would not be able to go beyond that point. That's as simple as that. They may be like King Agrippa, you know, that they can be persuaded, they can agree with it. And they can say, "You've almost persuaded me not to be a genuine believer," you see, who casts away all the false teachings of the church, whatever church a person may be in, the background, you know, one's own understanding. But unless God steps into the action there and initiates this process, this journey, and plans whatever comes from Him that cannot come from us, in us, we cannot go beyond that. And so most people are what some call head Christians or head Jews, you see. Or for that matter, it works in every other religion. It's in the head, but it's not in the heart. So they don't go beyond that. And so Paul answered, and he said, "I would to God," didn't say "I would to Jesus Christ," but "I would to God the Father, that not only you," because you see, only God can determine that, whether it's going to happen or not. And if it does not call anyone, as Christ said, "No man can come unto me unless the Father calls him." You see? And that's what he's saying here. Paul cannot convince him. Paul has no capacity, no any man has the capacity to convert anybody. For that matter, even Jesus Christ could not. You see? Many followed him. Tens of thousands, maybe hundreds of thousands throughout Judea and Galilee and other places, as they did, you know, with John. It says, you know, the whole countryside in Judea and Galilee and everywhere else, you know, they all went and were baptized and confessed their sins. But even Christ cannot convert them unless the Father initiates the process, opens their eyes and opens their mind. As he told Peter, you know, "Well, the only reason why you know that I am the genuine Christ, I am that person that the prophets and Moses talked about," you see, It's not because you were convinced by the prophecies and the law and all that, but because my Heavenly Father revealed it to you. You see, there has to be a personal revelation by the Father himself, not Christ. Christ cannot do it. God didn't give him in that sense the power to do it. Why? Because it's the Father who has to beget us to become his sons and daughters. He's the Father. He's the head of the family. You see, just like the mother cannot have a child unless the Father gets into the action. You see, and so it happens here. And so that's what Paul is saying here. I would to God that not only you, but also all who hear me today might become both almost and altogether such as I am, in the same faith that is, except for these chains. In other words, you know, I don't wish anybody this kind of fate. When you follow Christ, when you obey God, when you follow in the path of God, people, you know, don't like you. They hate you, even within your own faith. If they're not genuine ones, which the majority, the overwhelming majority are not. It's only the very few that God calls and deals with and gives them to Christ. Many are chosen, even among all those who are being called, but that is, you know, many are called, but only few are chosen. That's a reality. The majority go in the broad way, in the wide road that leads to destruction ultimately, even though they think that they are walking in the righteous path. And they all feel great about it. They think, oh, well, I'm a Christian. You know, some people think, well, I'm a good Jew, you know, I'm a good Orthodox, whatever. It's neither here nor there. Unless the Father deals with us on a personal basis, we're not going to be among the few that walk in the narrow path. You see? As Christ said, only few find it, not many. Because God doesn't call many, that's not the time, that's his plan. It's not, you know, the fault of men. You see? God planned it that way. He's calling only the very few to become the teachers for all the rest who are going to come later on. Only the first fruit. And so this is the reality. The majority of people don't understand it, even the high and the mighty in religion. They don't understand it. They think they know it all. They think they know better. You see? And their faith is totally contrary to the teachings that you find throughout the entirety of the Bible, from beginning until the end. Most of the servants of God were only few, always, from the beginning of time. Even in the nation of Israel, where all of them were exposed to the law of God and the prophets, and have known it, and were raised on it, that's in the days when they walked, you know, on the righteous path and not in idolatry. Only the very few among them, the prophets, they were called the prophets. They were the major ones, and then there were all those around them. There were the few always. They were the genuine believers and those who walked in the religion of God. That was the reality always from beginning until the end. The majority thought that they were the genuine believers. Now, they knew the law, they knew the prophets, yes, but they did not have a personal relationship with the Father and with Jesus Christ. And so it is to this very day. And of course, most people don't like to hear it. They're not going to agree with it. Well, it's neither here nor there. The day is coming when the judge of the whole earth is going to summon everybody to the judgment seat, and their eyes are going to be opened, and there aren't going to be any more confusion and misunderstanding and hatred or contempt for the law of God or those who teach it, and so forth, and there is going to be purity of knowledge and understanding. Then it says, only at that time they shall all know me from the greatest to the least. Now they don't, they think they do. And so that's what Paul is in essence saying here. And when he had said these things, the king stood up. That was the end of the conversation there. And the defense of the apostle Paul, and as well as the governor and Bernice and those who sat with them. And when they had gone aside, they talked among themselves, saying, this man is doing nothing deserving of death or chains. Yet he was kept in chains. Well, not in chains in the sense of imprisoned, because he was allowed to be in his own, in a place where he had freedom. People could come and he could, you know, his friends could come and talk to him, you know, brethren. In chains means in prison. Does not mean that he was shackled, necessarily, walking around with chains. Even though that could be a possibility, but not in the same manner as you do with a prison. That is in prison or with a prisoner that has committed and was caught and is known to be a murderer or a thief, whatever. You know, in this case, they know he did not do that. So they did not really treat him as an ordinary prisoner. And so they said, and they admit it, and they confess it, and yet they still kept him there. They said, this man is doing nothing deserving of death or chains. Then Agrippa said to Festus, this man might have been set free if he had not appealed to Caesar. So because he appealed to Caesar, he cannot be set free. Which doesn't make sense. If he has done nothing wrong, just set him free, let him go. Even if he appealed to Caesar. Well, you see the insanity that is there, even in their minds, it never dawns on them. If he had done nothing, why do you keep him? You see? Why not tell him, well, you don't need to go to Caesar, you've done nothing wrong, go free. Well, same people would have done that, but God and Jesus Christ have other plans for the Apostle Paul. They want him to remain in this state. They want him to appear before Caesar and the household of Caesar. There is still a work to be done that they were going to do in these conditions and not others. And so we see this, in essence, nonsense reality goes on. Verse 1, chapter 27, and when it was decided that we should sail to Italy, they delivered Paul and some of other prisoners to one named Julius, a centurion of the Augustan regiment. So it was a special guardian of the prisoners from the very regiment of the Caesar himself. And whether he was summoned over there or he was in the area or that was his job, like throughout the empire, where they had those kind of people to bring those prisoners that appealed to Caesar. And obviously that seems to be the case here. So entering a ship of Adramyttium, we put to sea, meaning to sail along the coast of Asia, speaking about Turkey. Aristarchus, a Macedonian of Thessalonica, was with us. And Paul does not expound here. Well, what does that mean? You know, was he a brother or whatever? It sounds like he was. Otherwise, why mention him? And the next day, we landed at Sidon, and Julius treated Paul kindly and gave him liberty to go to his friends and receive care. So you don't see a real prisoner here. You see, hanging around with shackles. You see, the chains that it's talking about here is the reality of being in prison, not necessarily hanging around with chains. You know, here he goes free and he goes to visit his friends. And obviously, you know, some soldiers go with him, but, you know, the centurion is not afraid that this man will flee. As it is, there is nothing against him. He's not a criminal. And when he had put to sea, from there, we sailed under the shelter of Cyprus because the winds were contrary. And when we had sailed over the sea, which is off Cilicia and Pamphylia, we came to Myra, a city of Lycia. Now all these events are going to transpire here. They're all orchestrated by God. The kindness of the centurion, the places where they went, the storm that came, where they could go to certain places and but not to others. All those things were being orchestrated by God and by Jesus Christ. So their will be done. And that's how they bring about their will, in spite of circumstances. And when we had sailed over the sea, verse 5, which is of Cilicia and Pamphylia, we came to Myra, city of Lycia again. There is the centurion, found an Alexandrian ship sailing to Italy, and he put us on board. And when we had sailed slowly many days and arrived with difficulty off Cnidus, the wind not permitting us to proceed. Why wouldn't the wind, you know, permit them to proceed again? God is in charge of the situation here. He's in charge of the weather. He's in charge of everything. And so whether you read the wind or the spirit, you see, meaning Jesus Christ, because wind and spirit in Hebrew are the same word. And maybe it was intentional here on the part of the Paul to use the word spirit or wind, you know, the same word that is applicable to both, and we don't know exactly whether he means Jesus Christ was the one doing it, you see, or just he used the weather pattern to create the situation. In either case, wind goes for both. Spirit and wind are the same in Hebrew, so it could be both ways, which it is in essence. And so the wind not permitting us to proceed, we sailed under the shelter of Crete of Salmon. Why is he in essence, tracing the route which they took and what happened here and there, we don't know. There are an awful lot of extremely major, important statements in the Bible that receive only sound bites, so to speak, just a little bit of a mention here. While here, you know, so many details that are, in essence, are neither here nor there. Ultimately speaking, there is nothing spiritual about all these matters, with the exception of showing the hand of God, the finger of God, the planning that goes behind there by invisible hands. And so we read here in verse 8, passing it with difficulty, we came to a place called Fair Havens, near the city of Lasea. Now when much time had been spent and sailing was now dangerous because the fast was already over. What does it mean, the fast was already over? Why is Paul mentioning that? He's supposedly the herald of Christianity, you see. Totally different religion. They don't go by Jewish customs or Jewish law or the Torah. Well, you don't see that. You see him mentioning the reality that the fast, and the only fast that generally is called the fast in Hebrew, in the language, in the religion, is the Day of Atonement, Yom Kippur, as they call it in Hebrew, or here, Yom Kippur. You see? So he's mentioning that. They had to go through that. One day, Paul, while on the ship there, and whatever other people, you know, that he knew there, maybe like this Macedonian, Aristarchus, well, they fasted on that day. So he's mentioning it. That's a part of the reality. You see? The law is not done away with. The truth has not been altered. A new religion did not appear on the scene. And throughout this book of the Acts that traces the foundation and the basis of the followers of Christ, the body of Christ, the church, as it was called later on, the Ecclesia, but it's not really the Ecclesia, it's the body of witnesses, as we mentioned from the beginning of time, from Exodus 12, you see, you don't see any difference there. Same religion, same truth, same God, same doctrine, same Torah, same Moses. Not anymore. Well, we had Moses before, now we had Christ. Christ is the one that gave the law to Moses. It's the same. And Jesus Christ is the same yesterday, today, and forever. And he's the one that said, heaven and earth shall pass away, but not one jot or one tittle shall pass from the law. And the Day of Atonement was an extremely important day in the plan of salvation and the work that Jesus Christ was to do on this earth. He was the ultimate goat of atonement. You see, the goat for the Lord. And so, you see the same law being followed by the Apostle Paul. Never deviated from that. And here we're talking about the end of his ministry almost. You see, he's not introducing any new religion. And when you bear that in mind, throughout all of his epistles that later on were recorded, you see, and canonized, and are read to this very day, unless you take that into account, you would not understand what he's talking about. And because people couldn't care less about all these statements here, overlook them because it didn't fit their own agenda, the pagan agenda, the pagan religion, which they called Christianity, well, they just had to rationalize and twist in the words of the Apostle Paul and wrestle with the scriptures to their own destruction, as Peter mentioned, in those days. And they do it to this very day. You know, so they think Yom Kippur or the fast, well, that's Jewish, you know, what's Paul keeping it for? Well, because Paul was a servant of Jesus Christ, he had to do it. That's the reality of it, and that will be done to the end of time, when the entirety of the plan of God is all fulfilled. And that's exactly what Christ said, until heaven and earth shall pass away. Not one, you know, the least part of the law will be done away with, because everything has a purpose. And as we mentioned many times before that, when you came in the scriptures to Ezekiel, you read there about the end time, the last 8 chapters, he mentions all these holidays, all the sacrifices, everything as it was in the days of Moses, reactivated, including the temple, you see, and the holidays. And so it is. So the Apostle Paul knows nothing about, you know, new religion, Pauline doctrine, Christianity, and all those things, you know, new faith. He knows nothing about that. He continues to walk in the faith. A Pharisee, all the Pharisees, yeah, he's son of a Pharisee to the end of his day. Never deviated from that. And that's what he taught to all, both Jew and Gentiles, and the kings of the earth, that, you know, the governors that he appeared before. He taught Christ. He taught the law, because they're all the same. And so we read that the fast was already over, and Paul advised them saying, "Men, I perceive that this voyage will end with disaster and much loss, not only of the cargo and ship, but also our lives." Why did he know that? Well, Christ put those thoughts in his mind to know. So he said, "Nevertheless, the centurion was more persuaded by the helmsman and the owner of the ship," that is, the one that was managing the boat, helmsman, you know, standing at the helm there of the boat, of the ship, and the owner of the ship, then by the things spoken by Paul. And again, God and Christ, you know, was orchestrating these matters, and he caused it to be this way. He could have done it the other way around, you know, caused the centurion to believe Paul rather than the other person. And so we read here, verse 12, "And because the harbor was not suitable to winter in, the majority advised to set sail from there also, if by any means they could reach Phoenix, a harbor of Crete," that's where you get Phoenix from, Phoenix, Arizona, "opening toward the southwest and northwest and winter there." Well, that was their idea. That was not the idea of God. And yet God caused it to be that way, because throughout all this voyage and everything that happens and the places where they visited and all the events that occurred along the way, God continued to do his work through the Apostle Paul. You see? And when God does whatever he does, man does not perceive it nor understand it. It seems to be strange and weird, and that we try to go contrary to it, and we all do it in our own lives, unfortunately, when we are not in tune with God. We think that what we say and do and think and what we see all around us makes more sense the way we do it and not the way God does it, because his ways are not our ways, so naturally we're not going to do it his way. By nature, his thoughts are not ours, so we're going to lean to our own understanding, thinking that this is the will of God and not the real will of God. That seems to be strange to us oftentimes. And so when the south wind blew softly, supposing that they had obtained their desire, now they can say, "You see, we told you." Well, they didn't know what was up, you know, in the sleeve of God, so to speak. And so putting out to sea, they sailed close by Crete, but not for long, a tempestuous head wind arose, called Euryclidon, or Euryclidon, and it was a very, very bad storm. Well, here, God was speaking. "So when the ship was caught and could not head into the wind, we let her drive," you know, let her just be driven wherever she wanted. And it just went wherever the wind, you know, drove her. "And running under the shelter of an island called Clauda, we secured the skiff with difficulty." They were barely managing to get closer there. And when they had taken it on board, they used cables to undergird the ship, and fearing lest they should run aground on the Syrtis sands, a location there, they struck sail, and so were driven. Again, they were not in control. God was in control. "And because we were exceedingly tempest-tossed, the next day they lightened up the ship." So they began to throw all kind of things up off the board to make it lighter. "On the third day, we threw the ship's tackle overboard with our own hands. Now, when neither sun nor stars appeared for many days, and no small tempest beat on us, all hope that we would be saved was finally given up." And Christ and God were now going to teach everybody a lesson there and do a work in the process. And that's the way they do things. We look at that. Events happen, tragedies, calamities, see, all kind of things seem to go wrong, and we think, where is God? Where is he in control? You see? He's maneuvering everything, manipulating everything, orchestrating everything. He's in absolute control, and in our blindness we think, where is God? Well, that's the way we function. We do not function by the Spirit of God. We function by power and might, our own, in our own understanding. God says, no, it doesn't work like that. It's not by power, it's not by might, it's not our own understanding. It's by my Holy Spirit. And here God is using the wind, which is called also spirit in Hebrew, to do that, to do his will. "Now when neither sun nor stars appeared for many days and no small tempest beat on us, all hope that we would be saved was finally given up." Why? Because people were not looking to God, who was controlling all things. And so they gave up. Well, Paul didn't give up. The others did. But after a long abstinence from food, then Paul stood in the midst of them and said, obviously they could not eat. You know, they were being tossed back and forth and people were vomiting probably all over the place. Nobody could eat. But Paul stood up in the middle there and he said, "Men, you should have listened to me." Now, a lot of people hear that and they don't like to hear it. You see, well, he said it to them anyway. He said, "You should have listened to me," because he warned them. And he warned them by the Spirit. "And not have sailed from Crete and incurred this disaster and loss." So he knew that God was, in essence, teaching them a lesson for being disobedient to his law. You see, the law that he gave them through the Apostle Paul, that means an instruction, a teaching, an admonition. Do this and don't do that. They were not willing to listen. So they needed to learn lessons. So all these things here that you see, not only in this story, in this scenario that we see before us, this is exactly what happens to us. When we do not listen to the voice of God, we do not recognize it as being the voice of God, we lean to our own understanding thinking this is the will of God, and God teaches us a lesson. And all kind of things, you know, go awry until we learn the lesson to trust in God, no matter how different things may be from the way we think they should be. And so he basically has to let them know, you were rebelling in essence against God. It's not the Apostle Paul. And so he says, "And now I urge you to take heart, for there will be no loss of life among you, but only of the sheep." So he already knows what's going to happen, and he makes it very plain to them, and now they're going to listen. And so he says, "For there stood by me this night an angel of God," that is, an angel of the God to whom I belong and whom I serve. He didn't say the angel of Jesus Christ, but an angel of God, the Father. He's the one in absolute charge, and he's the one orchestrating all these things. And obviously, Jesus Christ also is God, that is a divine being, is Elohim. And he said, "This angel told me, saying, 'Do not be afraid, Paul.'" And he may be speaking about Jesus Christ himself. He's an angel of God, a messenger of God, because that's one of his roles. And he said, "Do not be afraid, Paul. You must be brought before Caesar, and indeed God has granted you all those who sail with you." The Father is in absolute charge here. "And therefore, take heart," he says to them, "men, for I believe God that it will be just as it was told me." And now they're listening. "However," he said, "we must run aground on a certain island." Now when the 14th night had come, that is from the start of the trip, as they were driven up and down in the Adriatic Sea, about midnight, that's the Greek sea, the sailors sensed that they were drawing near some land. And they took soundings and found it, that means, you know, they would drop things into the water, you know, with a heavy metal or whatever, to find out, you know, how deep it is. And they found it to be 20 fathoms, that's a measurement there. And when they had gone a little farther, they took soundings again and found it to be 15 fathoms. Then, fearing lest we should run aground on the rocks, as it is, they told them, "Look, we're going to lose the ship anyway, so don't worry about it." Well, they still were. They dropped four anchors from the stern and prayed for the day to come, or wished for the day. You know, they were not praying in the sense of praying. So, at this point, as the sailors were seeking to escape from the ship, when they had let down this, the skiff into the sea, in other words, they realized, look, you know, this is just nothing but trouble, being on the ship. We want to get aground and just forget all about it. Now, the sailors oftentimes were not just professional sailors. Many times they put prisoners there to be the sailors in the old days. And so, these sailors, they were on that boat, and so they wanted to get away, and there were also slaves there, obviously, and prisoners. And so Paul now said to the centurion and the soldiers, "Unless these men stay in the ship, you cannot be saved. They're necessary, you see, for us." And so he's warning them. Well, this time they're listening to the Apostle Paul. And mind you, who is the Apostle Paul as far as Rome is concerned, and the centurion that is, and and the owners of the sheep and the sailors and all that, the captain, you see, a real nobody, and yet they find themselves in the presence of this man of God, and they begin to understand there is more to it, you see, than meets the eye. And so they listen. And obviously, God is also guiding their hearts at this point to listen, where before that he did not. And so we read, then the soldiers cut away the ropes of the skip and let it fall off. So at this point, they cannot flee. And as the day was about to dawn, Paul implored them all to take food, saying, "Today is the 14th day. Ye have waited and continued without food." Imagine that, for 2 weeks, no food, couldn't eat. Maybe they have drunk, you know, some water, but they didn't eat, and eaten nothing. "Therefore I urge you to take nourishment, for this is for your survival, since not a hair will fall from the head of any of you." So don't worry about your life, you're going to make it. Here's the man, Apostle Paul, a prisoner, and he's there, sort of now in charge, at least spiritually, encouraging them. People that know nothing about God, but they're beginning to see the invisible force of that mighty God that the Apostle Paul is serving. And so, listen, so we read in verse 35, "And when he had said these things, he took bread and gave thanks to God." Again, then he gave thanks to Christ, you see. Luke, who is recording all these things, had he wanted to show a difference between the God of Israel and the supposedly the new God, the God of the New Testament, would have made very, very plain. Now it's Christ. Forget about God. You don't see it as the manner of every Jew from their youth, raised on the law and the prophets. It's God that you give thanks to. It's God that Jesus Christ, while in the flesh, on this earth, that he taught everybody to give thanks to. You see, when you raise up the bread, you don't give thanks to Christ, even though he's the creator. You see, of all things, the sustainer of all of us, personally, that's his job. It is to God, to the head of the family, that he give thanks. He is the head of the religion, always the head, in the center of all things. Christ is not the center. He's the center of the plan of salvation, but he's not the center of all things. The Father is, was, and will be. There is no other religion. And those who do not serve God, his law, which many call in Christianity, you know, strict rules, the law, harsh, it's not for us. It's of the God of the Old Testament. You see, it's all a pagan religion, pagan teachings, liars and thieves and robbers of the faith of many who deceive them for the last 2,000 years. And they're all going to face the judge of the whole earth and be told the same. "I never knew you because you are lawless." You see, you're rebellious against the law of God. And God does not have a relationship with you, neither would I. And so throughout the entirety of the history of the people of God, be it in the old days and the days of Christ and those after that, you always see exactly the same thread, the same religion, the same faith, the same teachings, the same manner of doing things. And that's why 4 centuries down the road, when the leaders of the newly established, not of God, but of man, church that called itself Christianity, and they call themselves Christians, they said, "Look at those Nazarenes, you know, they do everything just like the Jews, in the same fashion, in the same manner. All exactly the same, with the only difference that they believe in the Messiah." You see, that's how far people go, where now the lies that they concoct in their own brains or inspired by another spirit become the truth, while the truth becomes a lie. And so they said, "Well, they're not like us. You see, they're still walking the law. Sabbath and circumcision and all the other things. And therefore, they're not Christians." Of course they are not. Not the kind of Christians that this religion was teaching or preaching to this very day. And so the genuine servants of Jesus Christ, ironically, were not called Christians by the pagan church, who call themselves Christians. Otherwise, you see, they are of a totally different religion than they are. They wouldn't be able to call themselves and those people by the same name, because they think that they are the genuine followers of Christ. Well, all the pagan religions always thought they've got the true church. The idol worshippers in Israel always thought they are the true worshippers of the God of heaven and earth, while the genuine teachers of God, the prophets of God, were considered to be lunatics and crazy and insane people who teach a foreign doctrine, a foreign religion. And so it is to this very day. That's why Christ never knows him. And so he tells him. And this is what he does. He gives things to God, to the Father, in the presence of them all. And when he had broken it, before, that is, he began to eat. Just like Christ always done, just like a Jew to this very day, an Orthodox Jew does to this very day. You see, you go to a home, a Jewish home, you see the Jew continues in the same manner. Ironically, does exactly the same things as Christ does, of course not in every way, and yet they're considered to be of a foreign, you know, another religion. Not supposedly, you know, the religion of Jesus Christ. Well, how many of those who call themselves Christians do that? You know, they take the bread, they give thanks to God, they look up to heaven, as Christ always did, as a Jew does to this very day, because that's where God is, and then they break the bread, and they oftentimes dip it in salt to show him the covenant. You see, it's symbolic of the covenant. So they have a covenant between the family there and between them and God. Remember, you know, reminding themselves always of the people of the covenant that God made with, you know, with his servants, his people. And then they divide it and give it to everybody else, and they all become one body. And that's what Christ alluded to, unless you eat my flesh and drink my blood. You see, and those were physical, symbolic things. And so he gave it to the disciples, and take, eat, you know, this is my bread, you know, this is my body, this is my flesh, symbolically, you see. Well, you don't see the supposed religion of Christianity doing this kind of things. And unfortunately, even many who are the people of God who have the Holy Spirit, they too, because of their background out of which they came, you know, they just continue the same customs. And it doesn't dawn on them that we have to live by every word that proceeds out of the mouth of God, and these things are. And we have to alter our thinking, our behavior, our conduct, our thoughts, our deeds, whatever we do, the way in which we did whatever we did, you know, our thinking, our comprehension. You see, God is not going to have the old religion that we came out of mixed with his true religion. We have to shed off everything. Not many are willing to do it, unfortunately, even among the genuine people of God. It takes a long time before they get to that point. And verse 36 we read, then they were all encouraged and also took food themselves. And in all, we were 276 persons on the ship. A lot of people. And yet God was dealing with all of them on a physical level, obviously, not a spiritual level. In other words, he doesn't give them the Holy Spirit. They're not going to be becoming, you know, his own servants. But just like he did with the children of Israel. He speaks to them, he talks to them, you know, he teaches them. And to the degree they're willing to believe it and walk in it and go beyond it, well, that's the way it's going to deal with them. Verse 38, so when they had eaten enough, they lightened the ship and threw out the wheat into the sea. They were carrying cargo as precious wheat. People don't, you know, just throw it away like that. Yet they had to. And that was the will of God. You get rid of all your physical possessions. You see the spiritual connotation there, entrust in me and me only to feed you, to sustain you, which he did. He created circumstances. He caused people to feed them and take care of all their needs. Once they have learned that, at least a measure of faith that God was teaching them to have, and they began to develop it. You see, but still on a carnal basis. That's all God was doing with them at that point anyway. But you see a measure of faith here. You know, they're doing all those things, and they're trusting that God is going to take care of them. You know, the God of the Apostle Paul. Verse 39, when it was day, they did not recognize the land, but they observed a bay with a beach. Landed on the beach there, onto which they planned to round the ship, if possible. And they let go the anchors and let them into the sea, meanwhile loosing the rudder ropes, and they hoisted the mainsail to the wind and made for shore. But striking a place where two seas met, you know, there was a sort of an undercurrent there, going in both directions. They ran the ship aground, and the prow stuck fast and remained immovable. Now they couldn't move anymore. But the stern was being broken up by the violence of the waves. And notice that, you know, how the look is just recording every tiny little detail there. Because all those things were a part of the plan of God, how he was dealing with carnal-minded people and teaching them faith, just like he was teaching his own people. And spiritual lessons for all of us. So when we go through all kind of experiences in life, we have to realize God is in every detail. He's managing everything. manipulating everything and orchestrating everything. He's the director of the film. He calls the shots. You see, the film comes about because when people go on the set, you see, to see how a film is being shot, they realize the director guides every tiny little movement. Everything is controlled. People don't do their own thing. The actors don't do their own thing there. You see, every tiny little scene, every detail is all recorded, pre-recorded, you know, in advance, and then told to the actors, this is what we are going to do at this point and that point, and then on the set instructions, and this is what is happening here. Gives you an idea about the God of heaven and earth, how he functions. And this is what happens at this point. But striking a place where two seas met, they ran aground, now they couldn't go beyond that, and the stern was being broken up by the violence of the waves, and the soldier's plan was to kill the prisoners. Not God's plan, but the soldier's plan. Why? Didn't want them to run away. Why didn't they, you know, want them to run away? Because the soldiers were responsible and accountable for them before Caesar. These people were being brought before Caesar. And Rome was very, very rigid in enforcing these kind of laws. If you are in charge of a prisoner, let him go. Your life is at stake. And so they would rather kill them. They can justify that to Rome. They didn't want them to flee. But they cannot justify the fact that they have escaped and they have no proof. So they wanted to do it lest any of them should swim away and escape. But the centurion, wanting to save Paul, because they were going to kill the prisoners, Paul was one of them. The centurion, he's in charge of the whole group here, wanting to save Paul, kept them from their purpose and commanded that those who could swim should jump overboard first and get to land. And the rest, some on boards and some on parts of the ship. And so it was that they all escaped safely to land. And you can see Paul going through that also. And he gets on a piece of board and he swims. And he's an old man. He's not a young man at this point. The end of his ministry. Yeah, that's the way God wanted it. That's the way Christ orchestrated it. And that's the way it's going to happen. And people who put their trust in God, no matter what they go through, they're not afraid. They're not afraid for the loss of their life because they are in the hands of God. And Paul learned that so many times, so many ways, and he could, because of that, impart this kind of experience on a personal basis of the faith, of trust in God, to the brethren. And so as you read later on, but all the things that he writes, you see all this become a reality in the lives of the Apostle Paul and the lives of others as he taught them about these matters. And so they develop faith in God no matter what they go through. As David would say, though I walk in the shadow of the valley of death, I fear no evil because you are with me. Chapter 28, now when they had escaped, they then found out that the island was called Malta, a very well-known island. And the natives of that place showed us no unusual kindness, for they kindled a fire and made us all welcome. Why? Because God put it in their heart. You see, Christ was orchestrating it. He's guiding hearts. He's guiding events. He's causing this to happen, that to happen. He's in absolute charge. He's the God of the heaven and the earth, and people are not aware of that. And so because of the rain, you know, they welcome there and they set, you know, kindle fire so they can get warmed up. Because of the rain that was falling and because of the cold. Cold and rain and wet and broken ship and he's floating on the water. That was the will of God for the Apostle Paul. And the Apostle Paul didn't think, well, if God is the God of love, well, how come? Because God is a God of love. All those things are happening according to plan. Just like you see in a movie. But that's another end of the story. But when Paul had gathered a bundle of sticks and laid them on the fire, even though they already had a fire, well, he created his own little fire there. And a viper came out because of the heat. That is sort of a snake. What does it mean, you know, a viper comes out because of the heat? You know, in other words, there is a fire there, you know, the snake draws closer to it to get a little bit warmed up. And so this is what we did here. It came because of the heat and fastened on his hand. You see, that's what the snake did. Why? Because God wanted to do something here. Again, he's in total charge and orchestrating every tiny little detail. And so when the natives saw the creature hanging from his head, from his hand that is, they said to one another, "No doubt this man is a murderer, whom, though he has escaped the sea, yet justice does not allow to live." Well, that's what they think first. But God is planning all things. And he's watching all things, and he knows what goes on through their mind. And so, this is what the Apostle Paul does now. "But he shook off the creature into the fire," and now the creature is just burned, "and suffered no harm, nothing." And that's unusual. That doesn't make sense. Another is going to be an opposite reaction. "However, when they were expecting that he should swell up or suddenly fall down dead because it bit him, but after they had looked for a long time and saw no harm come to him, they changed their minds and said he was a god." Well, these are superstitious people, and that's the way they think. And oftentimes people go like that from one extreme to the other. And in all that, they did not see God, the hand of God. But Paul did. And so we read here, as a consequence of that, God was going to do a work here. And so that's the reason why he was planning all these details. And we'll stop at this point again. Mordecai Joseph, greetings to all of God's people.